In Max's house, the game was called Ladies and Gentlemen. The participants included three preschool age daughters, one very happy to ham it up father, and the daughters were freshly bathed and pajama clad and ready to fly from couch to recliner. The father was glad to serve as the ringmaster, spotter, and catapult. Ladies and gentlemen, I would announce to the audience of one, Den Allen, who was wondering why we needed to do acrobatics before bedtime. Ladies and gentlemen, the Lucado girls will now fly through the air. The living room became a carnival, and I was the human tilt-a-whirl. I held the girls upside down and swung them around like they were just rag dolls. They spread their arms and giggled, and I tossed them onto the sofa. I flipped them over the ottoman. I caught them as they leaped off the back of the recliner. They loved it. Never once did they question my judgment or strength. Their mom did. A pediatrician would have. But never in a cycle of 1,000 flips and flap-flops did my daughter say to me, "Have you thought this through, Dad? I'm not sure you can catch me. Are you sure you know how to do this? Do you think you ought to practice with the pillow?" Never once did they think I would drop them. Dad says he can, then he can. Dad says he will, then he will. They trusted me completely. After all, I was their father. Oh, that we would trust ours. Jesus once declared, "The work God wants you to do is this: believe the one he sent." John 6:29. Everything begins with faith, and the absence of it results in wilderness years, and the presence of it results in promised land living. It's really that simple. It was for Joshua. He didn't fly through a living room, but he trusted God to open rivers, to collapse strongholds, pry the devil's fingers off his inheritance. Joshua trusted God, and most of the people followed his example. But one man refused, Achan. Never heard of him? Well, you're not alone. We sort of gravitate to the happier Bible stories. We love Peter's redemption and Saul's conversion and Samson's restoration. But Achan's corruption? It's not the stuff of Veggie Tales or Sunday school songs. Yet his story survived the final edit of the book of Joshua. God kept it in there for a reason. It's not a happy story nor a pleasant read. You might brace yourself for a solemn warning. The prior chapter ended in the high note. So the Lord was with Joshua. Jericho was demolished. No rock or enemy left standing. The stage was set for the Hebrews to run the table. The citadel was in shambles. The word was out. The Hebrews were emboldened. Joshua's face was on the evening news. So the Lord was with Joshua, and his fame spread throughout all the country. Verse 27. So the Lord was with Joshua. So, what a great word. But sadly, the end of chapter 6 became a but in chapter 7, verse 1. But Israel violated the instructions about the things set apart for the Lord. A man named Achan had stolen some of these dedicated things. So the Lord was very angry with the Israelites. And here's the dossier on Achan. He had a wife. He had a family. He had oxen and sheep and donkeys and a tent. He had a place in the bloodline of Judah. But most of all, he blatantly and deliberately violated the command in Joshua 6:18. Do not take any of the things set apart for destruction, or you yourselves will be completely destroyed. You'll bring trouble on the camp of Israel. Everything made from silver, gold, bronze, iron is sacred to the Lord and must be brought into his treasury. Those instructions are pretty clear. Don't touch the stuff. Don't make necklaces out of the gold or make medals out of the bronze. No souvenirs, no trinkets, no Jericho jewelry, no kidding. God has high hopes for these Hebrew people. Through them, the scriptures would be written and the prophets would come and the Messiah would descend. God needed them to trust him and him alone. Rely on their own strength? No. Rely on their own ability? No. Their own resources? No. God is enough. And hasn't this been the message of Joshua thus far? Who opened the Jordan River? Who led the people across on dry ground? Who appeared to encourage Joshua? Who brought down the Jericho walls? Who fought for and delivered the people? God. He cared for his people. And even in the wilderness, they never went without provision. They may have grown weary of manna nut bread, but they were never hungry. He gave them not just food, but clothing, good health. Moses once reminded the Hebrews in Deuteronomy 8:4, your clothes did not wear out. Your feet did not swell during those 40 years. In fact, God echoed that message in 29:5. During the 40 years that I led you through the wilderness, your clothes did not wear out, nor did the sandals on your feet. The following phrases were never heard in the wilderness. Man, do I need to soak my feet in some Epsom salts. Or, bummer, my robe has another rip in it. Hey, new sandals, where'd you get them? Podiatrists and tailors and cobblers had a lot of time on their hands. No want for food, no need for clothing, never a blister or a bunion. God provided for them. And not only that, God promised to provide more. Again, quoting Moses, for the Lord your God is bringing you into a good land, a land with brooks and streams and deep springs gushing out into the valley and hills, a land with wheat and barley and vines and fig trees and pomegranates, olive oil and honey, a land where bread will not be scarce and you will lack nothing. A land where the rocks are iron and you can dig copper out of the hills. In God's promised land society, he was the sole source of blessing. And he knew what would happen if the soldiers started collecting treasures. They'd stop trusting him and start trusting stuff. Think about it. I mean, they were simple Bedouin. Most of them were conceived and born in the wilderness. And Hebrews in Jericho were kind of like gypsies in Rodeo Drive. The gold would bedazzle them. Bracelets and rings would entrance them. The shekels and the jewelry and the silk. And the Hebrews were ill-prepared to own such booty. Achan proved the point. He saw the bling. He forgot his king. And God's discipline was both immediate and severe. Warren Wiersbe writes, never underestimate the amount of danger and damage one person can do when outside the will of God. Abraham's disobedience in Egypt almost cost him his wife, Genesis 12. David's disobedience in taking an unauthorized census led to the death of 70,000 people, 2 Samuel 24. Jonah's refusal to obey God almost sank a ship, Jonah chapter 1. And that's why Paul admonished the Corinthian believers to discipline the disobedient man in their fellowship, because his sin was defiling the whole church. God insists on obedience to his commands, no matter how small, how strict they may seem. Only then can we enjoy his blessing. From Glory Days. A few miles south of Jericho sat the encampment of Ai. Joshua circled the name of the city on his wall map and told his officers to attack. Flush with their Jericho victory, he assumed the small town would be easy pickings. After all, the whole village only held about 12,000 people, and Joshua had that many on his night shift. He sent a reduced battalion, 3,000 soldiers, to take the village of Ai. Was Joshua in for a surprise? The town was a kennel of pit bulls. The people of Ai bit back. Joshua's division raced home, discouraged and disheveled and licking their wounds. Verse 4, the men of Ai chased the Israelites from the town gate as far as the quarries. They killed about 36 who were retreating down the slope. The Israelites were paralyzed with fear at this turn of events. Their courage melted away. Joshua's mighty men of battle curled underneath their blankets and trembled. He didn't know what to think. He was coming off a string of great victories. Jordan and Jericho and the rescue of Rahab, and undefeated, undaunted, undeniably the new force in Canaan. And now this? Our hero had a meltdown. He tore his clothing. He fell on his face. He prayed like the Hebrews of the wilderness days. He regretted the invasion and actually accused God of setting them up for defeat. Oh, that we would have been content and dwelt on the other side of the Jordan, verse 7. Joshua came undone. But God was not done. Verse 10, the Lord said to Joshua, "Get up. Why are you lying on your face like this?" Joshua pulled himself to his feet, and God told him there was trouble in the camp. Verse 11, Israel has sinned and broken my covenant. They have stolen some of the things that I commanded must be set apart for me, and they have not only stolen them, but they have lied about it and hidden the things among their own belongings. And that is why the Israelites are running from their enemies in defeat. It's not that the people of Ai were so formidable. It's what that the Hebrew camp was poisoned. God told Joshua in so many words to find that rotten apple and get rid of it before it destroyed the whole bushel. So at God's direction, Joshua did a tribe by tribe, family by family, then man by man review until Achan confessed. The treasures were hidden in his tent. Verse 20, I have sinned against the Lord, the God of Israel. Among the plunder, I saw a beautiful robe from Babylon, 200 silver coins, a bar of gold weighing more than a pound. I wanted them so much that I took them. They're hidden in the ground beneath my tent, with the silver buried deeper than the rest. It's not hard to recreate Achan's stumble. Along with the other soldiers, he had walked through the fallen city. Walls down, rubble everywhere, conquest complete. All of the spoils of Jericho lay there unprotected, gold and coins, fine garments. Everyone saw the stuff. Everyone else remembered God's command. They saw the treasures. They kept going. But Achan, when he thought no one was looking. He paused, cast a glimpse to the right and a glimpse to the left. I saw a beautiful robe from Babylon, 200 silver coins, a bar of gold weighing more than a pound. I wanted them so much that I took them. From Vine's Expository Bible, notice the progression of Achan's sin. He said, I saw, I coveted, and I took. Sound familiar to you? In the Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve saw the fruit. They took, they ate. David, upon the rooftop of the palace, he saw Bathsheba's body, and he sent, and he took. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the pride of life, referring to what can trip us up, the physical, the emotional, the volitional. Achan's problem was covetousness. I have a feeling Achan must have taken a look at the Babylonian garment and thought, you know, for 40 years I've been wearing this old robe and these same old shoes. I deserve a break. I owe it to myself to live it up a little bit. Old materialism got a hold of him. And that's one of the main problems Christians are experiencing today, materialism. We're continually bombarded by advertisements that say whoever wants to be happy or complete and satisfied in life needs to drive this car or wear this perfume or drink this drink. And that incessant pounding of advertisements causes us to fall for the same thing that Achan did. Achan fell for what ultimately caused his death. And when you fall for the old materialistic world and its subtle temptations, you'll fall for the very thing that results in spiritual death. I saw, I wanted, I took. Max Lucado adds, others saw, others surely wanted, but only Achan took. Why? Well, perhaps he wanted a payoff. After all, his side had won the battle, or even an ace in the hole, some money to fall back on in case the Hebrews lost. A nest egg would be nice, as would some negotiating power should he ever be taken captive. Whatever his explanation or reasoning, the bottom line is Achan did not fully trust God. He didn't trust God's wisdom. He didn't trust God's ability to provide or protect. Achan doubted God's ability to catch him. So he broke the pre-invasion oath which he and others made. This was the indictment God gave. He has transgressed the covenant of the Lord. Joshua 7:15. And Achan must have been among the men who pledged, whoever rebels against your word, Joshua, and does not obey it, whatever you may command, will be put to death. Achan took matters into his own hand, and more literally, he took treasure into his tent, and he entangled his family in the deceit. The judgment was swift, the punishment stiff. Achan and his family were publicly executed, their possessions burned. A monument of stones was built as a warning to the people. It was a solemn day in Gilgal. And it's actually a solemn warning to us. God is jealous for our trust. He doesn't request it or suggest it or recommend it. He actually commands it. His unvarnished message is clear. Trust me and me alone. A similar unraveling happened in the New Testament. The church had begun its own era of glory days and miracles and sermons and baptisms and growth. And the book of Acts is full of fruit and fanfare until chapter 5, until Ananias and Sapphira. And like Achan, this couple stole what belonged to God. They pledged to sell some property and give the money to the church. But when they changed their minds about the gift, they acted as if they hadn't. And like Achan, they lied. Like Achan, they died. Their bodies were carried out, and great fear gripped the entire church, Acts 5:11. So on this topic of faith, it seems God is pretty serious, deadly serious. Achan in Gilgal, Ananias and Sapphira in Jerusalem. Their graves remind us to be careful. What would a search of our tent reveal? A cabinet full of faith, or a closet piled with ambition? A pantry of hope, or a storage bin of stock certificates? For our own sakes, the story of Achan reminds us, don't put your trust in stuff. There was a time that I thought it was essential to drive a Beamer, to wear a Rolex, to present in an Armani suit, to sign with a Mont Blanc pin, all little symbols of business success. But to what end? Been there, done that. Paul speaks plainly on the lifestyle of covetousness. 1 Timothy 6:9, but people who long to be rich fall into temptation and are trapped by many foolish and harmful desires that plunge them into ruin and destruction. To the covetous person, making money or obtaining wealth becomes an end to itself. Jerry Vines adds, accumulation becomes the aim of one's life. Yet according to Paul, money is deceptive. It promises what it cannot deliver, contentment. Real contentment is not obtained by the addition of things, but rather the subtraction of things. Losing the desire for more leads to a contented Christian life. Paul said to Timothy, 1 Timothy 6:17, command those who are rich in this present world not to be arrogant or put their hope in wealth, which is so uncertain, but to put their hope in God, who richly provides us all, everything for our enjoyment. The rich in this world, that's you. That's me. If you had enough education to hear and understand this message, or even had the means to be able to get here to church on this Sunday morning, you're more than likely a very prosperous person. Prosperity is a common consequence of faithfulness. And prosperity is okay. Paul didn't tell the rich to feel guilty about being rich. He just urged caution. Nothing breeds failure like success. Money is just a short-term condition. The abundance or lack of it will only last for one life. So we needn't get tangled up in it. Imagine if you were living in the South during the Civil War and you'd accumulated a whole lot of that Confederate currency. And through a series of events, you decided that the South was not going to make it. They were going to lose. Your money would soon be worthless. What would you do? Well, if you had any common sense, you'd get rid of your Southern sense and you'd put every penny into the currency that is to come and prepare yourself for the end of the war. Max adds, are you investing in the currency of heaven? The world economy is going down. Your wallet is full of soon-to-be useless paper. The currency of this world will be worth nothing when you die or when Christ comes, either of which may be any moment If you and I stockpile earthly treasures, not heavenly treasures, what does this say about where we have put our trust? Glory days happen to the degree that we trust Him, that we obey Him. Here again, Paul's counsel to Timothy: teach those who are rich in this world not to be proud, not to trust in their money, which is so unreliable. Their trust should be in God, who richly gives us all we need for our enjoyment. All honor and power to Him forever. Selah.